for this morning, United States against Volpentesta.
May it please the court, my name is Bo Brindley and I represent the defendant appellant John Volpentesta. Mr. Volpentesta presented a number of issues in his brief. The one that I'd like to focus on here this morning is the question of whether an erroneous denial of his motion to substitute counsel rendered involuntary his subsequent decision to proceed pro se.
Now, let me just give you a hypothetical. This isn't quite the facts of Mr. Volpentesta's case, but it happens from time to time that a district court has allowed a defendant to roll through a couple of lawyers, or maybe several lawyers, and a time comes when the district judge says, you know, Mr. Smith, I'm done. You're going to take this last lawyer, or you've essentially waived your right. I can't just keep going through. And you're either going to represent yourself or you're going to take this last lawyer. Do you believe that all of those conversations are unlawful coercion?
I don't think so. I think it depends on what the circumstances are that the defendant is complaining about with that last lawyer. And the reason I think that's important is because I think the central issue here was whether or not there had been a complete breakdown in communication with the lawyer.
But, you know, defendants are often very bright people, and some of them learn that all you have to do is say to the judge, there's been a complete breakdown in communication, and the defendant can make sure that happens. The lawyer is very likely to stand up and say, yes, Your Honor, that's right. You know, he won't talk to me at all, or he's his own worst enemy, or whatever the lawyer wants to say. So you think there's an infinite right to keep getting appointed counsel when somebody's playing that game?
I think it's really going to be fact-specific. I don't think there's an infinite right. If there's some evidence that the defendant is doing that, that somehow there is not a legitimate breakdown in communication.
Well, there's a couple of years here of, for example, refusing to take advantage of extraordinary accommodations. I've never seen a case, for example, where the judge, in response to these kinds of complaints about a slow computer in a cold room at the jail, says, okay, anytime you want, the marshals will bring you over here to the courthouse to meet with your lawyer and go over this stuff. And the defendant keeps saying he's sick, he doesn't want to go. It looks like he's refusing to cooperate.
There's a point at which the defendant becomes less cooperative. Early on, the defendant was, and I think a lot of what we're talking about is where the role of fault lies in this analysis, which is part of it. The Martel case said that fault has a role to play, but no one has ever been clear on what role that is. I think what's definitely true is we can't have courts of appeals stepping in every time as a parent saying, well, who started it, and that resolving the issue. But in this particular case, I think if you go back to where it starts, it's Mr. Volpentesta wanting to be able to see the discovery materials in the case.
But Mr. Volpentesta has very high standards. He wants, you know, thousands of pages photocopied, not, of course, at his own expense. And I guess what I'm trying to focus on, you've agreed that there is a time, that there can come a time when the district court can pull the plug and just say, look, this is it. You know, you either are going to proceed on your own or you're going to stick with this last lawyer. I will say that looking at the record of what Mr. Byrd and Mr. Fagan were doing, they seem to have been pushing through all of this lack of cooperation pretty well. So I can understand why the judge may have made the judgment that this is not, in fact, a case of such a dramatic breakdown that he had to give Volpentesta one more chance.
And, Your Honor, I just don't think that is supported by what the lawyers were saying here.
Don't we defer to the district court's assessment of where, you know, sort of how bad has it gotten?
I think we do if the district court's asking the right question. But in this case, the district court explicitly stated, and this is in our reply and it's in our brief before that, that the inquiry when they were doing the substitution of counsel doesn't have to do with your relationship with your attorneys. The only question the district court was asking is whether they were competent. But they can be competent, and at the same time, there can be a complete breakdown in communication.
That's parsing things awfully finally and in a way that's hostile to the district court's approach. I mean, we're talking here about a right to effective assistance of counsel. That's the standard, right?
That, yes. Yes, although the complete breakdown in communication plays into that. I think that
it's relevant to that. But
yes.
Then the real question, to follow up on Judge Wood's point, is that in essence, does a district court have to allow a defendant to make it impossible to put him on trial?
No. Okay. I don't think. I think that you could have a situation where the facts were such that the district court could say, well, you're not going to be able to go to trial at all. I understand the point that Your Honor is making, but I don't think those are the facts here. Mr. Volpentesta met with Mr. Byrd. It wasn't like he refused to meet with him. He continued to meet with him, but there came a point.
Mr. Byrd continued to file motions and was arguing things, and of course Mr. Volpentesta winds up with Mr. Byrd as standby counsel, consulting with him. The district judge can observe all that, right?
Certainly. But I don't think that means the question that the Martel case really suggests, you have to look at the degree of breakdown in communication and the functionality, pragmatic functionality of the relationship between the lawyers and the client. And here, these are lawyers who are saying...
Doesn't that analysis, though, basically assume some degree of good faith effort on the part of the defendant?
Yes. But I also think there is evidence of good faith effort on the part of the defendant. It's not the case that this defendant started out as one of these guys who wants to go pro se from the beginning, and they're out there. He didn't do that. He wanted to have a lawyer, and he wanted to see his discovery. And I think it's important that when he's saying he can't, this is not a small problem. When he's got thousands of pages and he's in these county jails where you can see one page at a time and you can have the computer for an hour and a half, he's not going to be able to even know what the discovery is. That's why
the judge responded to that, right?
Sure, yes.
With accommodations that the defendant then wound up rejecting.
There was a point in time when the defendant did not go and meet with his lawyers during the accommodation. There were times when he did as well.
He hardly took advantage of this generous offer on the judge's part to let him examine these documents at the courthouse. He's constantly saying, oh, I can't do it this. I mean, he really turns his back on what the judge is trying to do. Seemed to me the judge bent over backwards.
I think by that point, I think what has to be noted here, by that point, he felt like he could not trust the lawyers that he had. And the reason I say that is because Mr. Byrd was repeatedly telling him, I'm going to give you the hard copies. He admitted he told him that, and then the time when he was supposed to give them came, and it didn't happen. And to the defendant, from his perspective, he's seeing a broken promise after a broken promise. And, well, he's sitting in jail. The idea that it could take all these months just to get him the hard copies does not seem reasonable in his eyes as he sits in jail. And as a result, he felt that he couldn't trust his lawyers, and that led to the breakdown in communication. Now, I think you have to look at what was being said between lawyer and client in front of the court. These are lawyers who are calling him Kafkaesque, who are saying he's so narcissistic he has a mental disorder in front of the court. If that's the kind of dialogue that's going on between you and your lawyer, where they're saying, really, basically, every time we meet, it's an exchange of accusations and recriminations. We're accusing him of not helping us. He's accusing us of not doing what we're supposed to do. What would be more of a complete breakdown in communication than that? There was no functionality to this. And I think one thing that's relevant is this quotation in one of the motions to substitute that was denied, where the court talks about the defendant and his lawyers reminding the district court of people in a rowboat, if you remember the quote, where
they're rowing around, and they
keep going in a circle. But here's my problem. That means we don't have a functional relationship, and the district court recognizes that. And then there was no point after that where the district court found or any of the lawyers said that they were in a position where they could get the rowboat moving forward, to continue the analogy. And because... I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, if you want to save any rebuttal time.
I just wanted to raise, if I could,
yes,
one other issue with you, Mr. Brindley. Do you think the rights of victims are relevant in this analysis? Specifically, the right of victims Congress has provided to proceedings free from unreasonable delay, particularly since any substitution in this case was likely to lead to a continuance for another year or so for new appointed counsel to get up to speed.
I think there is some consideration that has to go into that, Your Honor, but I don't think that there's any way that the right of these victims can outweigh a defendant's right to be represented by functional counsel with whom he can communicate. If there's a total breakdown in communication, I don't think the role of a delay for victims can at all...
If that's right, If that's right, though, if it's that absolute,
I think it
then
is.
We get into the ad infinitum problem. Is a defendant can break down the relationship with any counsel.
If there was some evidence that the defendant was doing this purposely with multiple attorneys, I don't see that evidence. The first substitution of counsel happened quickly, and here he
it
kept...
It was after a year.
After, I guess quickly
the,
in the,
PD had
in
been
the
there,
overall
the
perspective.
The federal defender had been there for a year when the defendant complained, right?
I think that's right in terms of the timeline, Your Honor. What I also think is important to remember is, in terms of the, talking about delay, thousands of these pages were provided to the defense right before the trial date. If you got thousands of pages of discovery, 9,000 pages right before the trial date, that delay is going to happen anyway. It's you can't review 9,000 pages in a few days before the trial. No lawyer can. And so I don't think the idea that the delay was the thing that makes it the case that we had to force him to not have another lawyer. I think if there's a complete breakdown in communication, there's a lack of functionality, then in that circumstance, pursuant to Martell, you have to give him another lawyer. I think that's the state of the law. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Versman.
May it please the Court. In the Martell case, this past term in the Supreme Court, which appellant's counsel has cited, the Supreme Court stated, because a trial court's decision on substitution is so fact-specific, it deserves deference. A reviewing court may overturn it only for abuse of discretion. And the record that we have in this case, Your Honors, demonstrates conclusively that neither U.S. District Court Judge Capalla nor Magistrate Judge Mahoney abused their discretion in refusing to substitute in a fourth appointed counsel for this pro se defendant. In response to each of the defendant's motions, the district court conducted very thorough, very intensive inquiries into the situation that was behind the defendant's motion for substitution. In addition, in each case, the district court considered the timeliness of the defendant's motions, and towards the end, when we had the trial date set, the court indicated that it felt that these motions were untimely. As Your Honor, Judge Hamilton has noted, the victims do have a right to have their case prosecuted without abusive delay, and the court was taking that into consideration when it was ruling on the timeliness issue.
Do we see that explicitly in the record? I know you all argued it in the district court.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't know that the judge specifically cited to that, but I believe he did reference the fact that the victims have a right to proceedings without delay. I can't cite to that off the top of my head.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Versman, looking at Mr. Volpentesta's complaints, obviously the majority of them, as far as I can tell, seem to center on his ability to review the documents that were going to be used. Was he complaining about anything else, motions that his lawyers weren't making or theories they weren't? He has a subpoena of witnesses problem, too. I'm just trying to see, get a handle on what he thought the flaws were.
Yes, Your Honor. There were a variety of different complaints. In the beginning, they did relate to this discovery issue. And as I believe the panel has picked up on, first of all, discovery was provided to the defendant in a timely fashion in electronic form. He didn't like that. The court came up with another scenario where it allowed or it required the U.S. Marshals to transport him up to the courthouse to review discovery. He wasn't complying with that. Then we get into the third situation with the paper discovery. Mr. Burden did encounter some problems with that, but ultimately did get that paper discovery to him.
The U.S. Attorney's Office that was doing all this photocopying, or who was printing off these thousands of pages of documents?
The printing problem was in Mr. Bird's office. He was having some difficulties printing the files that had been produced to him in TIFF format. He indicated to the court that his printer could only print one or two pages per minute, and that caused his problem in delay. So then he had to go to the court and get permission to hire an outside.
Yeah, or FedEx.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, right.
Because it was going to an outside source, there was some redaction of grand jury materials that had to go on, so that caused a bit of a delay. And then there was an issue with Kinko's over the bill. Certainly there was a delay. However, it wasn't an unreasonable delay. It was something that was explained to the defendant, and it certainly didn't poison the relationship that the defendant had with his counsel. I would indicate that after the paper copies were provided to Mr. Volpentesta, we don't see much reference to that issue later on. Your Honor, you asked whether or not there were other disputes that were going on, other complaints. And what we saw was that the disagreements between defendant and his counsel really centered upon all of the unreasonable demands that Mr. Volpentesta was placing upon his counsels. And if I could just give the court a couple of examples. Mr. Volpentesta demanded that Mr. Byrd do work on his unrelated state court cases in McHenry County, in which there was a body attachment warrant pending. Mr. Volpentesta demanded that Mr. Byrd work on his paternity and child support action that was pending up in the state of Wisconsin. And to mollify the defendant, Mr. Byrd actually did do some work on those cases. Mr. Byrd also demanded that his attorneys file numerous frivolous motions. And to their credit, as officers of the court, Mr. Byrd and Mr. Fagan refused to file what they believed were frivolous. But we see that coming up again and again in the motions to substitute counsel. Defendant's frustration that his counsels won't file what they know to be frivolous motions. Mr. Volpentesta also demanded that his attorneys subpoena bank records, despite the fact that the bank records had been provided to the defense in discovery. And when the defense counsel asked Mr. Volpentesta, "Well, explain to us what's missing here," he refused to do that. He couldn't cite the records that were missing.
Mr. Hirschman, there's a pretty good record that the defendant was being unreasonable here. And I guess the concern I have is on this legal standard here. That is, we want defendants to have effective representation of counsel. That does depend upon at least some degree of functioning in the relationship between defendants and their appointed counsel. To what extent can or should the district court get into the what one might call the blame game, but in essence assessing where fault lies in the breakdown of a relationship? Or should the breakdown itself be enough to say, well, we really need to start over?
Well, Your Honor, I would go back to the standard that was enunciated by the Supreme Court in the Martell case, in which the court stated that the standard is that the district court must look into the asserted cause for the complaint, including the extent of the conflict or breakdown in communications between lawyer and client, and the defendant's responsibility for causing that conflict. So according to the Supreme Court's recent Martell decision, the court can get into the blame game, as described it, Your Honor, and can look at whose responsibility it is. And I would point out to the court that when you look at the record here, and I can't remember which of Your Honors indicated it, but this is a situation where you have a district court that really bent over backwards for this defendant, appointed him not one, not two, not but three different court-appointed counsels here. So the issue here is whether the district court abused its discretion in refusing to appoint a fourth counsel. Your Honors, in terms of the unreasonable demand, I just also would point out that Mr. Byrd indicated on March 26th of 2010 that he had recently gotten a demand from Mr. Volpentesta, or an order from Mr. Volpentesta, ordering him to not work on any other cases except for Mr. Volpentesta's case until it went to trial. Now, this happened on March 26th, and Mr. Volpentesta's case wasn't set for trial until June 1st.
So does that excuse? Was it Mr. Byrd who made the comment about the Kafkaesque nature of this relationship? I mean, that doesn't help a relationship.
Actually, Your Honor, that was Mr. Fagan.
That was Mr. Fagan. Yes. Well, either way.
That was an interesting comment.
He'd be out of line. I mean, probably shouldn't have been said.
I wouldn't have phrased it that way, Your Honor. However, I think that when you look at the context of what was going on here, that was a response to the situation where you have a defendant who is making all of these unreasonable demands. There was no attorney anywhere that could have lived up to the expectations and the demands that Mr. Volpentesta was placing on Mr. Fagan and Mr. Byrd. So that comment was made in response to that, and I think it's a situation where you have unreasonable demands and you have disagreements over trial strategy, which this court has previously held is not sufficient to reverse district court on the issue of substitution of counsel. Your Honors, unless the court has any further questions, I would cede my time. I would simply ask that the court affirm the conviction of Mr. Volpentesta in this case.
All right. Thank you. Your time ran out, but I'll give you a final minute, Mr. Brindley.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The question here is ultimately whether the district court abused its discretion and put the defendant in a position where he wasn't making a voluntary choice to go pro se. And the district court, I think, abused its discretion, one, because I think there was a mistake of law in not focusing on the breakdown of communication and saying the relationship between him and his lawyers didn't matter when it does. So I think you have abuse of discretion. But I think when you look at the facts, what you have is a situation where lawyers are saying it's an irretrievable conflict. We can't get any information from him. He's not giving any information from us. He's saying that. They're saying the district court acknowledges that they can't work together functionally and then denies the motion to substitute counsel. When you have that complete breakdown, whatever the circumstances, and a no functionality to the relationship between attorney and client, it is my position that substitute counsel has to be offered. Otherwise, there's no way that defendant can make a voluntary choice. He was making a voluntary choice, according to the district court, when in fact the district court had acknowledged that he had a relationship with his counsel that was not functioning. And in addition to that, Your Honor, he was in a position where his lawyers were saying, we can't deal with him, we can't get information. And when they can't get information from him, that is a complete breakdown. And so we would ask that you reverse the district court, vacate the conviction and remand. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not, Mr. Brindley? So we appreciate your